One of the fundamental controversies that has swirled around in the various churches of God over the last few years is that of government. It's been extensively written about, it's been bragged on, argued over, accused against. It's been used as both a prop in terms of supporting someone's argument and a hammer in terms of trying to destroy someone else's. It's been used to both unite and to divide and also to comfort and to punish. I have a thick folder in my file cabinet on government, and I pulled it out this week, and it was absolutely chock full of booklets and articles, newsletters, handouts, forum posts when the forum was functioning, and a considerable amount of personal notes going back a number of years. One of the items in that folder was a reproduction of the Good News magazine from 1939, and the front page of that was an article that Mr. Armstrong had written. And way back then, he was arguing very strongly against any kind of centralized structure in the church at all. And he likened it to Gentile rule in Babylon. Obviously, Mr. Armstrong changed his mind in a fundamental way from 1939, which is an incredibly long time ago. He changed his views on government dramatically, and the church did go on and did, as you and I, in most cases, participated in and experienced, did a great work under his direction and care, and many great things were accomplished. But in the end, it does not appear that most of those who participated in that work remained true and faithful, even under that great structure that we saw at that time. And so the argument continues on among what I would now call the diaspora Church of God, kind of like the Jews were scattered into all nations, it seems, almost as if we have as well. The argument continues on as to what form of governance in the church really ought to be. Now, other than my opinion that it should be somehow under me, I really don't have an opinion of that. When I opened that file on government, it was like opening a church scrapbook, because there was a lot of historical things in there that I had filed over the years. And as you open a church scrapbook or a home scrapbook or a scrapbook of your family, there's a lot of emotions and memories that flood through your mind as you recognize the pictures and remember the circumstances that then took place. I pulled out of the midst of that folder a 20-page constitution from Ambassador College in 1978 that I wrote as a senior. When Big Sandy closed in 1977, they had already selected the student body officers. And so when the colleges were combined, and I had been selected in Big Sandy to be student body president, and I went over to Pasadena, and they already had one. In fact, they had one of everything that we had, so we had co-presidents, co-vice presidents, co-class presidents, co-reps, co-everything, at least through the upper ones where the decisions had already been made. We settled down to work that year, and student government, fortunately, actually paid. I had tuition and most of my school expenses paid for, and it was actually my full-time job. And so I had a place to work, and it was something I could contribute myself or focus myself on totally. And so I went to work that year. The college had changed and was functioning with a little different structure than it had in the past and was also pursuing accreditation, and certain paperwork functions and formats and records simply needed to be in place. And so I took on as a task that I would write a constitution for the college and update the one that was in place, and then work it all the way through the systems and get it approved and edited and changed, and eventually it would go to Mr. Armstrong. That was the theory. And then that could be in place. And so I dedicated myself to that. It took a lot of my time, and pretty soon I found that my classes were getting in the way of my work. That's kind of like being in sports when you're in college. You know, all of a sudden your academics are in the way of your reason you're there. But so I started to drop classes, and I found that in order to remain a full-time student, all I had to take was 12 hours of credits. Well, I was already in my fifth year of college because I had college before I went to AC, and so I had no lack of credits. And I found, too, that to try to keep up my grade point was rather difficult because of the time I was now spending in student council matters. When I walked into school, I set a goal for myself as a freshman on what grade I wanted as I graduated. And I was ahead of that mark, and so I sat down with a calculator every so often, and I would add up all of my credits for the college career, all of my grades, and then I would estimate what my credits and grades would be to finish, and I knew exactly where I had to be to set my goal. And so I let my grades begin to fall, to drop, and I backed my classes off until I was at the very minimum. If they would have had a class in underwater basket weaving, I would have taken it. Anything to lighten that load so I could finish my task. And I did. I spent that year focusing on student government, student council activities and responsibilities in writing that constitution. At the end of the year, with the constitution essentially finished and some very minor revisions left to remain in final approval, at the end of the year there was a crisis in the church and the college was closed. I remember graduation being particularly terrible that year. I had a chance to address the student body. And I looked out there, and the majority of the students were not seniors like I was and were walking out the door with their diploma. The majority of the students that year had nowhere left to go to graduate and would now have to transfer somewhere else without an accredited institution to support them. And it was a particularly horrible time. I remember packing my scuba tank. I was in one of the dorms living, and I got me a box and I started packing my scuba tank, and the reason I remember that so well is because I packed it in crumpled up pages of that constitution. I had a stack of those old constitutions that I had spent, you know, it was like for me 9 months of trying to almost bring to birth something that then got killed. I mean, it was my life. I gave up a year in part of my focus in education to accomplish that task. And then I remember with a pile of those old constitutions, ripping them off, crumpling them, and stuffing them into a box with my scuba tank to pack it. And what I learned from that, looking back especially, because it took me a while to refocus, but how student government was structured back then didn't turn out to be very important. It just wasn't as high a focus as I really thought it had to be. In Matthew 20, in verse 17, there's a passage here. When Christ is focused on one thing, his disciples are focused on something else. And notice how quickly they come in with their focus and try to push his out of the way. Matthew 20, verse 17. Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside on the road. And he says, "Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death. They will deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify, and on the third day he'll rise again." So it says, you know, horrible times are coming, and I'm going to suffer, and I am going to die. And then, in that context, everyone crowded around to give him great sympathy and support. Right. The mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons and kneeled down and said, "Well, can I ask you something?" "Well, what do you want?" She says, "Well, how about my two sons sit on your left and right in the kingdom?" In other words, Christ is telling them about this horrible, terrible trial that's on its way, and the first question he is presented with in response is, well, where can we line up and what's in it for us? What are we going to get to do in this structure as it now proceeds forward into the kingdom? What kind of government is it going to be, and where is my place? Where can I hang my hat? Jesus answered and said, "You don't even know what you're asking." He says, "Are you able to drink of the cup that I'm about to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with?" You know, he's asking them now. I said, "Well, look, can you pay the kind of price that has to be paid to attain that high of a calling?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, we can do that." He says, "Fine, I'll let you pay the price, but you don't get the calling." Now, wouldn't that be something? That'd be like saying, you know, "I'd like to have a house like yours. Are you able to pay for it?" "Yeah, I am." "Okay, you can pay for it, but you can't have the house." I mean, you don't want to ask those kind of questions. Because Christ said, "Fine, you said you can, I'll let you pay. But I really don't have what you're asking for to give you. But for the other benefits and for your own character and for the example that you'll set, then I'll let you participate with me in that." He says, "I'll let you be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with, but to sit at my right hand or on my left is not mine to give. It is for those to whom it is prepared by the Father." And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two. Why do you think they were indignant? Why, they were probably indignant because they were really offended that anybody would ever consider promoting themselves, right? Wrong. I believe they're indignant because somebody got in line in front of them. You know, when you're in line at the ticket window or for the parking space or at the bank, if somebody got in front of you and just stepped in line and took over, that's kind of what causes indignation. And so I think the 10 kind of felt like they'd been aced out and they didn't appreciate it. And so Jesus had to address the attitudes that they expressed. He says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great, let him be your servant." Now, this does not mean you put your leader into servant position. It means you, as the leader, take servant position. We are to be a willing sacrifice, not a demanded one. We do not require of each other all of these good and right and perfect things. They are ours to give because God requires it of us. "Whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many." Christ's relationship to the church is our best example of government in the Bible that we have. He sacrificed himself willingly, not because we demanded it. How could we demand the sacrifice of Christ? We cannot. We have no right. But Christ gave himself willingly for us, and that is our example of service in the church. Now, ideally, that should be portrayed in the marriage relationship as God intended the marriage to be. And in Ephesians 5, verse 15, it talks here about what our perspective should be. And it compares then by an example of the marriage. But we often start in verse 22. I try to read verse 22 to Michelle two or three times a day, but really we have to start in verse 15, and verse 15 is the beginning of the context, and then why that other issue is now brought in. "See then that you walk circumspectly, not as fools, but as wise." Now let's be careful on what you do and the kind of decisions you make and what your focus is going to be. "Redeeming the time because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be unwise, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Don't be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but be filled with the Spirit." Don't get sidetracked. Don't waste your time where it shouldn't be spent. And don't get off doing things that are unprofitable. "Speak what to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing, making melody in your heart to the Lord. Give thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, submitting to one another in the fear of God." The reality of the marriage relationship is that both the husband and the wife submit to each other in a right and proper way. Then it goes on to the specifics of that. "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord." My mom one time got rather upset about the marriage ceremony when my brother got married, because the pastor actually had the gall to quote something out of the Bible like this and used the word, you know, the S word, in the marriage ceremony. And she was rather upset about that because, you know, that had never worked in our house, so why should it be applied to anyone else? But anyway, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as also Christ is the head of the church, and he's the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything." And it says, "Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish." It says, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself." It says that a man is to submit himself in love to his wife. And it says that a woman is to submit herself by giving honor and respect to her husband. And you go through there. It says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife. The two shall become one flesh." It's a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. And so when you boil it down, it says that the man's focus overall is to submit himself in love, and the woman's focus, and I guess this isn't totally inclusive, but in fundamental principle, to submit herself by showing honor and respect. Now that's very important to understand, because our society militates against that. Absolutely militates against that. And we do have the unfortunate tendency, all of us, you and I both, to absorb certain elements from our society that we shouldn't. I've had a couple of discussions recently, or even over the last few weeks, on these issues. And now, forgive me, but if I punch your button here, don't sign off, because I've watched this process. You know, we all have certain buttons, and boy, I'm going to tell you, when you punch those buttons, that's takes a while for the brain to re-engage. So as I go through this, bear with me on this point. We live in a society, as I said, that militates against the marriage relationship and, frankly, government in general. Is husbands love your wives a dirty word? Is it a dirty word? I don't think so. I really don't think it is. I'm not saying that all husbands love their wives, or I'm not saying that that is one of men's strengths, is to love their wives, but I still don't think it's a dirty word. Is, though, wives, submit yourselves to your husbands a dirty word? Well, I think it is. Now, when we've had our little discussions and I started punching everybody's buttons, it hasn't always come out quite, you know, we don't always have exactly the right view. I don't mean the right view. Maybe that's Freudian. Maybe that's what I do mean, but we don't always have the same view. We were discussing this at home the other day, so I said, okay, let me take it this way. Woodridge School is right across the street. I said, so let's just put this into perspective. If you went to Woodridge and you took every adult in the school, all the faculty, the teachers, the staff, the principal, the custodians, take every adult in the school, and we're going to ask them two questions. And the first question is it a good thing for a husband to really love his wife even though she's not being responsive to him at that time? What would they say? We kind of thought, well, okay, they'd probably say it's a good thing. All right, is it a good thing for a husband to really love his wife even though she's not being responsive to him at that time? We thought, well, probably they'd say it was still a good thing. I said, okay, let's ask them a second question. Is it a good thing for a woman to really submit herself to her husband even though he is not being responsive to her at that time? Well, we weren't quite as convinced that you'd get the same response. My guess is that you'd have something like, what do you mean by submit? What do you mean by alone? What do you mean by is? You know, what do you mean? What do you mean by submit? Nobody in our minds would have asked, what do you mean by love? Because that kind of unconditional thing is an ideal that is still in general valued, even though it's not necessarily always applied. But I believe, and I think I could convince at least a few, that if the question of submission came up, the question would follow, what do you mean by submit? Submit seems to be more of a little different thing, something that needs to be maybe a little more conditional. Well, I think that's social warpage. I couldn't find that. I couldn't make my spell checker spell that word out. So I put it on there anyway, but it kept rejecting that word, and I had to leave it in my notes. I believe the question really is, are we willing to be servants or not? Are we willing, regardless of what society says, regardless of what we are encouraged or not encouraged to do, before God, are we willing to be servants or are we not? The problem is, in the church at times, and everywhere around us as well, form and substance often get confused. I've heard the saying that the reason it's more important for women to be beautiful than to be smart is because it's easier for men to see than to think. Now, I doubt that's true, but it's amazing that that carries a certain amount of weight to it. Fancy things make us look good, but they won't make us be good. And so there is a tendency to desire form. You know, we'd rather appear right sometimes than to be right. We'd rather have the right government in our mind than to be the right government, because it's easier. We can kind of have righteousness by association instead of righteousness by being responsive to God. There's a totally different focus there that takes place. Would you rather have a loving atheist neighbor or a spiteful Christian one? Now, who'd you rather live next to? Okay. Would you rather have form or substance? I go for substance every time, I hope, except for in my weakness when I don't know what I'm doing and get carried away like we all do. But, you know, if I have a chance to really consciously process it, I'll go for substance. I'll try. Matthew 23 is an argument of form over substance. Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to the disciples, and he said, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." What's the point? Government. Moses' seat. Government. Okay, that's the issue. Now there's ramifications that come out of that and issues that now begin to be addressed. "Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, do it. That observe and do, but not according to their works, because they say and they do not do." The form they had was right and fine, but the substance did not follow. And Christ goes on to address that. "They bind heavy burdens, hard to bear. They lay them on men's shoulders. They themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. All their works they do to be seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad, enlarge the borders of their garments." There's physical things they wore according to the command that came to represent righteousness as compared to matters of the heart. They appeared to be righteous. They loved the best places at the feasts, the best seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men, "Rabbi, Rabbi," looked up to and recognized. It's talking about government, but what Christ is actually addressing here is attitude and approach. He goes on and begins to tie it into what that attitude and approach should be. Verse 11, "He who is the greatest among you shall be your servant, and whoever exalts himself will be abased, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." And then he goes on and he gives some specific examples, and I'll not read all of them, but at least some. Verse 15, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell," Gehenna hell. You point him toward his own damnation. You know, it's not a euphemism here. "As yourselves." What good does it do to go out and preach reconciliation and relationships to someone if you can't bring them in and show them reconciliation and relationships where you're asking that they be brought? I say that's a bit of a hypocrisy. If you're going to preach righteousness to someone and then bring them in, then you ought to be able to at least give evidence and show them righteousness where they come. Or it's hypocrisy. It says, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say if you swear by the temple, it's nothing. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, then you're obliged to perform it." In other words, if you're going to give the money to me, that's required. If you are just going to have the intention of doing some good work, we can forgive you for not having carried through. I mean, it's a rather self-serving approach that he's addressing here. It just goes on and on. Verse 23, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You pay your tithes, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faith." I don't care what the numbers are. I know the numbers affect me, but I guess in terms of what I strive to do, I don't care what the numbers are. The numbers of broadcast dollars, the numbers of the PMs, those have meaning and importance, but the bottom line is justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides, strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish. It looks good. You have form. You can put it out in front of somebody and they say, 'Wow, what a nice piece.' But inside, it's full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup, and then the outside may be clean also. Substance first is what's being addressed. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You're like whitewashed tombs, which appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. The primary lessons of government are not form at all, and they do not proceed from a particular structure any more than a wonderful relationship automatically proceeds from being married. It doesn't work that way. The primary lessons of government have to do with how we live our lives and how we treat each other, and they have to do with how well we work together with unity. When Michelle and I lived in Pasadena, there was always a big church picnic or an activity, and literally at times there were thousands of people participating. And because you worked on campus and you played on campus on the Sundays and things, you'd have your ball games, and boy, I tell you, every time I ache or groan a little bit, I think back that I actually used to play sports, and I think back to Pasadena running around on that AstroTurf and all the things we did. We used to have we used to play tug of war with a rope, and we have teams, but we couldn't call it a tug of war. We were a church, so we called it a tug of peace because we figured that was, you know, a little nicer terms, but it was a tug. And so we had teams, and I used to watch that, and I'd watch the teams, and I had a team as well, and I you know, one guy calls on the side when you get professional on this, and then you have your team that pulls, and one guy actually calls the cadence, and you get your team together, and it's an issue of unity and strategy. And I began to watch that rope and how that thing worked, and you know, none of us had taken any classes in tug of war, so we really didn't know the dynamics, but I used to watch that, and I finally figured out that if I could get my team, when the tug of peace started, to just lean down on their haunch real low and plant both feet and not move a muscle and just hang on that rope and let the other team wear themselves out, that we would win. And so we tried that, and it was amazing. We absolutely just rocketed through the system because no one had figured this out. But our team would lay down that rope and pull down real tight to the ground and just hang it. And then the other team would be jerking and pulling and groaning and sweating. And when they would start to break up, you can watch their feet, you know, then I'd say, pull, pull. And then our team would just start to march that rope on the other side, and the other team just fell down. And it was really a lot of fun. Government in the church is supposed to be something that contributes to unity, not increases division. It is something that draws us together rather than causes us to measure ourselves apart. Church government has too often been used to divide rather than to unify, and in some cases it even became a form of self-righteousness in that it said, I am right, therefore you must be wrong. Form is not a guarantee of substance. The right form of church governance will not fix a failed marriage. It will not raise our children. It will not study our Bibles, and it will not bring us peace. The right form of church government will not draw us closer to God. The real issue of church government is not in trying to figure out how we should rule over each other, but rather in how we should be willing to rule over ourselves. And those who use it in other ways, quite frankly, have used it to the harm and the injury of us all. Form, as I have said, is the right kind of church government, which can become righteousness by association. Substance is the right government, us doing what is right. That's to truly be responsive to God. And what is form without substance? To reverse the book of James, what is works without faith? If faith without works is dead, then works without faith is dead. It's the same equation. Form without substance is dead. I want to share with you what I think some of the lessons of government are, those that are after me being in charge. But what I really think some of the lessons of government are. Daniel 6, verse number 10. It says, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed because this decree had gone out that you couldn't worship anyone but the king. And he went into his upper room and his windows were open and he knelt down and prayed three times a day and gave thanks to God as his custom was. The men who had put this law through then assembled and found that Daniel was praying and making supplication to his God, and they accused him to the king. And then they reminded the king that he couldn't take his word back because that was against the law. Therefore, he had to hold Daniel accountable. And in verse 16, so the king gave the command. They brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Verse 18, the king went to his palace, spent the night fasting. No musicians were brought before him. His sleep went from him. The king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. And the king spoke and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel said, O king, live forever, forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. It says the king was exceedingly glad, and he commanded that Daniel would be taken up out of the den. And Daniel was taken up with no injury at all because he believed in God. Now, we probably think that this is the lesson, and it is one of the lessons, to trust God and to let him deliver you and to never back down or turn away from putting God first. But the lesson that I want to illustrate is in verse 24. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel and cast them into the den of lions. And notice who got cast in with them. Their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever even got to the bottom of the den. Their families were destroyed as a result of the governing process they chose to participate in. That's a lesson of government that is very, very strong. And the lesson is that no decision stands alone. That when you have authority or responsibility and you make a choice, that choice is going to impact and affect someone else. And if you are wrong, someone else is going to suffer with you who may or may not even have had anything to do with what you chose to do. Now, that's a very high responsibility. And it's very important to understand. It applies very directly in our families. Psalm 127 is, I would say, a very direct connection to that principle. Psalm 127, verse number 3. Children are a heritage from the Lord. What does it mean when you receive an inheritance? Somebody has taken something of theirs and given it to you. And they have turned over responsibility for it, and now you have responsibility for it to do with as you please. So children are a heritage from the Lord means that God takes something that is his, and he gives it to us, and now we have responsibility for those children. The fruit of the womb is his reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are children in one's youth, because at that very, very early age, you can point and direct your children toward a target. And you have a very great impact and ability to do so at a point in time. The older they get in various ways, the less access you have to that directing process and to point them in that way. Happy is the man who has a quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed. They shall speak with their enemies at the gate. Those that sat in the gate were the leaders of God's people. That's just saying that you can contribute and that you must and that I must toward the success of our children to take over leadership positions in their turn as well. I've actually counseled individuals who are having particular troubles in their lives, and I have said facetiously, and I emphasize facetiously, especially with a sermon that's going out on internet, nobody can come up after the sermon in that case and ask you for clarification. But I have actually said on more than one occasion, why don't you just take a club and beat your kids and get it over with? Now, I do not mean, and they know that I do not mean physically to do that. My point being this. What they are doing in their lives and the choices that they are making or not making is so destructive to their own family and to their children and their children's potential that it's no different than if they took a club and simply went and beat them up themselves, because that is the impact of what is then taking place. And I say that because it has a dramatic effect. Why don't you just take a club and beat them up yourself? That's government. And it's a principle of government that no decision stands alone. Everything we choose in that way has a ripple out and affects someone behind us. God gave us our children as a heritage, as arrows to point toward a target, and it is our responsibility to do that in a right and proper way. Number 16. You know, it's interesting to do that. You don't have to figure out what the real, right, best, ultimate, most righteous possible form of church government is. Because that's not the issue at all. That's really quite secondary in that case. Number 16. Just another example that kind of reinforces this very same type of thing. Verse 1, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram took men, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, and by children it says here the leaders of the congregations, representatives, men of renown. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said, you take too much on yourself. All the congregation is holy, every one of them. The Lord is among them. Why do you exalt yourself? Now, this passage of Scripture has often been used as a hammer to bring out government and beat it over someone's head to make sure that everyone submitted properly and accordingly. I think we should submit. Personally, I think we should submit willingly, sacrificially. I think that brings unity and peace. But I don't use this scripture for that point at all. You know the story, how they went up and made accusation and promoted themselves and tried to tear down someone else. And verse number 20. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, said, separate yourself from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. And they fell on their faces and said, God, God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with the whole congregation? So the Lord spoke to Moses and said, speak to the congregation and say, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. So everybody did, but who couldn't move away from the tent? The wives, the children, they were under that authority and that culture in that time, and in this circumstance, they quite frankly, sat there and remained, and it goes through here. Tells everybody to get away. And Moses said, you're going to know if these people are destroyed by a very dramatic thing where the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up, that that was God's choice. And if nothing really happens, then I guess you can know that God is not working through me. And it said, verse 31, it came to pass as he finished speaking these words, the ground split apart under them, the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up and their households, and all the men with Korah and all the goods, the servants and those who remained there in support of him. And they went down alive into the pit, and they perished from among the congregation. You know, it's a terrible thing. Everything we do impacts somebody, and sometimes significantly. What happens in government when daddy doesn't train sufficiently to make a good living in this life? What happens if daddy mopes around and fusses and doesn't really focus on his role as provider and caretaker and leader in the family environment? What happens to those who are responsible to that governmental structure? What happens when mommy doesn't care for the home and the children and they grow up fending for themselves? What happens when somebody doesn't help them with their homework or care for them and nurture them when they're sick? You know what happens, and so do I. The same thing happens to them that always happens, and what happens to the church or any other structure is corruption, corrosion, and decay. Why is government so often a package deal? because the family is a package deal, and the government of God is based on the family of God, and being part of that family is what we have been called to do. And one of the very fundamental lessons is the impact of the responsibility we have to exercise our service in a right and proper way. Sometimes the greatest lesson is not even learned by the person who appears to have suffered the most. Numbers 12, going back just a few chapters. Numbers 12. It says, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman who he'd married, and he had married an Ethiopian woman. So regardless of what the issue is, it says, yeah, this was true. And they spoke against him for it. And they said, well, has the Lord indeed only spoken through Moses? Doesn't he also speak through us? And the Lord heard it, as if, you know, he misses something now and then. It says, Moses was humble more than all the men on the face of the earth. So Moses' attitude wasn't quite the same as theirs. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses, I've had it. Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. They came out. You know, you can imagine what that must have looked like. I mean, when something happens at home and I say, Megan and Derek, come here. They know it's not to receive the Medal of Honor. They know that this is, you know, run and gun time. And they came out. They came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle, called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. And he says, hear my words. He says, if there's a prophet among you, I'll make that known, and I will speak to him. He says, my servant Moses is faithful in all my house, and I speak with him face to face, even plainly, not in dark sayings, and he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? He says, the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. When the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous and white as snow. And Aaron turned toward her, and there she was, a leper. And Aaron said to Moses, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us. Excuse me? Is Aaron a leper? Miriam is a leper. Do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly and in which we have sinned. You know, you might tend to think, well, has he got a mouse in his pocket? What's he talking about us here? I mean, Miriam's the one who seems to be paying the price. Please do not let her be as one who's dead, whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb. And Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. And the Lord said to Moses, you know, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and after that she may be received again. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days. Aaron went down to the local pub and had a beer and waited until she was restored to the house. I don't think so. And the people did not journey till Miriam was brought in again. The whole nation had to sit and park on a bucket until this situation was restored. Now, the only way I can describe that to you is through an experience that Michelle and I had one time when she became a leper. A little different in the way it took place. But when we lived in Pasadena, we used to go up in the mountains above Pasadena, and we would go hiking, and there was stream courses up there and trails and really fabulous trout, bighorn. I've seen bighorn sheep, actually personally seen them, and carried some horns even out of the stream beds up in the mountains. But we were up there hiking around one day. Michelle is absolutely just deathly allergic to poison oak. And we had been walking in shorts, and her legs were scratched up from going through brush and climbing through these trails. And we came on a great big large patch of poison oak, and we had to go right through the middle of it. We were headed up to get to the top road so we could walk back to the car. Otherwise, we had to go all the way back down, all the way up the stream bed, all the way back up the other side. And I just didn't want to do it. And so I looked at it, and I says, well, okay, you step here, and you step here, and you step here, and you get through the poison oak, and be careful, we'll be all right. So she said, she's under authority, and I'm big King Kong. I'm leading her along, you know, Gunga Din, going through the bushes, and she's following. So I went through, and she followed behind me, and we got the car, and everything was great till about a day or two later, she started to break out. She really broke out. She broke out so bad from all those scratches where the poison oak now got in the direct cuts, like giving her an IV of poison oak, that that she couldn't sleep in the bed anymore. We had to lay out a bed for her on the floor in the front room, and she'd groan and moan and lay around. She broke out into big sores and oozing, and you know, I could be real descriptive, but I'm just telling you, it was bad. Bandages soaking up the oozing abscess from the sores. And terrible, terrible shape. And you know, you could look at that and say, well, you know, Mark's down at the bar having a beer waiting for his wife to get well, but it didn't work that way. I was in terrible, terrible distress because I knew that was my fault. I made that decision. She followed me, and now she suffers. And we had to go to the feast that way and travel to the feast and work all the way through. And we traveled that year to Alaska and rode back in a Jeep all the way down the Alcan. And it was a long, long, enduring trial that went on for weeks. And I was tormented at her continual suffering because I knew that that was my fault. And so sometimes, quite frankly, the lesson can be learned even by the one who doesn't appear to have suffered the most because of the responsibility that they knew that they had. God wants us to learn to be responsible for each other. That's what unity is all about. Unity is sometimes portrayed governmentally as coming from the top down. Fine, I'd like to see unity from the top down. But we won't even be in the kingdom of God if the unity also does not come from the bottom up. You can forget about your example if it isn't something that we produce on our own. Right church government simply will not produce God's character in us. Character is a matter of the heart. It's God's Spirit changing the nature of our mind, and it's our being responsive to that. God said that He would bring a new covenant, and that He would change the hearts of His people, and that He would put His Spirit in us. And when He spoke of a new covenant, He talked about us repenting and being forgiven and receiving His Spirit, and He would be our God, and we would be His people. In Ezekiel 36, it doesn't specifically mention the new covenant, but it mentions the issues involved, and as a passage I'd like to use to illustrate this in verse 16. Ezekiel 36:16 says, "The word of the Lord came to me and says, Son of man, when the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own ways and deeds. And to me their way was like the uncleanness of a woman in her customary impurity." It was like filthy rags. And when the Bible uses that term, that's what it means, this kind of filthy rags. That's what it's talking about. He says, "Therefore I poured out my fury on them for the blood that they had shed on the land, for their idols which they had defiled it, and I scattered them among the nations." Israel wasn't responsive to God, didn't fulfill His will, didn't stay faithful and loyal to Him, and He scattered them among the nations. Interesting, I can't help but wonder sometimes if there isn't a little bit of a parallel to the church. There may be other reasons, there may be more reasons, but I can't believe in my mind that there is no connection at all. "I judged them according to their ways and their deeds. Where they went, they profaned my holy name. When they said of them, 'These are the people of the Lord,' and yet they have gone out of His land." And when people looked around and said, "Well, that's the church, and look at them." Brethren, we embarrass each other sometimes. And we cause people to blaspheme God's name because they look at us and say, "Well, but you claim to be the people of God. You've taken His name yourself." He says, "I had concern, though, for my holy name, and I took action." He says, "I will," verse 23, "sanctify my great name." Verse 24, "I will take you from among the nations, and I'll gather you out of all countries and bring you to your own land. I'll sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. I'll cleanse you from your filthiness and from your idols, and I will give you a new heart. And I'll give you a better form of government, and you'll all be under the right form, and therefore you'll be righteous because you have what I really want. I'll give you a new heart," he says. "And I'll put a new spirit within you, and I'll take the heart of stone out of your flesh, and I'll give you a heart of flesh. And I'll put my spirit in you and cause you to walk in my statutes and to keep my judgments and to do them. And you will be my people, and I will be your God," is what he says. "You will be my people, and I will be your God." If God raises up one person to lead us, and if he would just have the courtesy of showing me who he is, I will follow him. And if God raises up a dozen, I will follow them. But the proof of where God is working is not, in my mind, going to be in the system itself, but rather in the Holy Spirit, where God chooses, therefore, to dwell in us. I appreciated Perry's sermonette. He spoke about love. And he spoke about love in the context of unity. That's substance. 1 John 3:10 is just the same author in another place. 1 John 3:10. In this, the children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. What does manifest mean? What was manifest destiny? It was the obvious destiny in our eyes. So to make something manifest means to make it evident. And it says, in this, the children of God are going to be made evident from the children of the devil. They're going to be, a distinction will be drawn. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. From the beginning of what? From the beginning of creation. From the first moment that God put his hand to build and to produce and to secure his family. And it goes right on to show. The example goes all the way back to Cain. Not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. When the Bible says that people will be persecuted by their own family or by their own friends or by their own acquaintances, it's not going to be the righteous persecuting anybody else. It's going to be the evil persecuting the righteous. Because his own works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not marvel, my brethren, it is the world, if the world hates you. We know we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren, and he who does not love his brother abides in death. Whosoever hates his brother, who's your brother? Well, it better be all, in a spiritual sense, all of those who have God's Spirit. And obviously, we do not draw a corporate distinction on those lines. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. 1 John 4, verse 20. If someone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen, how can he love God whom he has not seen? And this commandment we have from him, that he who loves God must love his brother also. What is the right form of church government? Well, whatever it is, it must incorporate these verses as fundamental, not just to the spoken word, but to the actions. Not just to the form, but to the substance of what is there. Love is indeed tied into unity in the church. And that's substance. And that's what the right form of government is all about.